I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. As many of you know, I live in Southern California, and last week, the state of California announced that 49%, nearly half of the more than 2,500 COVID-19 deaths in our state, have taken place in at least 387 nursing homes located throughout California. Until she passed away in February, my wife Jean spent almost 11 years in 5 different nursing homes, and I spent about 4,000 days visiting her in those nursing homes. So it's difficult for me to read about this unacceptably high death rate occurring in nursing homes without speaking out, because what I keep hearing and reading about is how the COVID-19 pandemic has overwhelmed our nursing homes, and how our nursing homes are bravely battling to protect their residents. And I have no doubt that that's happening right now. However, my experience in spending those 4,000 days observing how at least 5 different nursing homes functioned when there wasn't a pandemic going on tells me that without making fundamental changes to the oversight being given to nursing homes, to the frequency and thoroughness of nursing home inspections, and to the accountability associated with nursing home Medicare billing, all of this and more can happen again. For sure, the COVID-19 pandemic has created new challenges to providing quality health care in nursing homes, but it's also exposed the very large shortcomings in care that have existed in some nursing homes for decades. And now that everything has been laid out in the open for all to see, the nursing home industry is actively lobbying Congress to be made exempt from any lawsuits that might hold them accountable for the quality of care that's been provided for far too long in far too many nursing homes. I realize that this isn't the right time to raise these issues. The problems that I observed in 5 different nursing homes here in California aren't in any way related to the COVID-19 pandemic, and I'll have more to say about all of that at a more appropriate time. But nursing home care has always been an awkward conversation. Jean's case wasn't unique among people with very aggressive cases of progressive MS. No matter how hard we try, our family members battling very progressive cases of multiple sclerosis will often need more round-the-clock care than can be provided at home. And as we find our way past COVID-19, our loved ones will still find their way into nursing homes. It's my hope that when they make that transition, they find that things are better than what I often found them to be. For the past 8 weeks, we've been talking about COVID-19 and MS, and I've reminded you that there wasn't any data available on the effect of COVID-19 on people living with multiple sclerosis. That's finally changed, and we're beginning to see some limited data here in the U.S., as well as data coming out of Italy. My guest today is Dr. Robert Shin. Dr. Shin is a professor of neurology at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital, and a fellow of the American Neurological Association and the American Academy of Neurology. He's been widely published in medical journals and textbooks, and he's received multiple awards and commendations for his teaching expertise and his clinical excellence. Today, Dr. Shin is going to update us on what we're learning from this newly published data about the effect of COVID-19 on MS. We'll also get into whether someone getting Ocrevus infusions today should be worrying about the effectiveness of a COVID-19 vaccine. We'll talk about the things that people living with MS should be thinking about as our local communities begin to reopen for business, and we'll get into how the COVID-19 pandemic might affect MS care in the future. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Robert Shin, there are a few other things that you should know about. As COVID-19 testing is becoming more available, people are discovering that the test itself can be somewhat uncomfortable. The test typically involves swabbing the back of the nasal cavity and getting to the back of the nasal cavity requires that the swab travels further up the nasal cavity than people might be expecting. There have also been some concerns raised that this test could actually miss an infection. If you're a regular listener, you might remember that a few weeks ago, when we were breaking down what COVID-19 tests were all about, I told you about a COVID-19 test that relied on getting a saliva sample instead. That test was developed at Rutgers University, and when the FDA approved the test, they notified Rutgers that the test could only be performed in a healthcare setting under the supervision of a trained healthcare provider. But as we continue to see on a daily basis, things can change quickly. And this past week, Rutgers received FDA authorization for that saliva sample to be collected at home. So you can expect to see and hear more about the availability of a much more comfortable FDA-approved COVID-19 at-home test kit that relies on a simple saliva sample. You don't have to watch more than a minute or two of any news report to understand that COVID-19 is taking a serious economic toll on families everywhere. And for some families, that means that even the basics, like having enough food, are no longer guaranteed. If you're living with multiple sclerosis, cancer, or rheumatoid arthritis, the COVID-19 Emergency Food Assistance Program has been launched by Team Rubicon in collaboration with the Patient Advocate Foundation. This program provides a one-time grant of $500 to patients with an identified financial need to help pay for food and nutritional needs, including groceries, food delivery and pickup, and medically tailored meals. The program will benefit thousands of families across the United States, and it's being funded by a $7 million grant from the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation. Team Rubicon is a nonprofit organization that serves communities by mobilizing veterans to respond to natural disasters and humanitarian crises. And the Patient Advocate Foundation is a nonprofit that provides case management services and financial aid to patients with chronic debilitating illnesses. The COVID-19 Emergency Food Assistance Program will use Team Rubicon's 120,000 veteran volunteers to facilitate food and grocery deliveries free of charge, while the Patient Advocate Foundation provides financial assistance. If you're living with MS in the United States, facing financial hardship, and you'd like to learn more about this program, please visit teamrubiconusa.org/apply now, and I'll include that link to the details and the online application in today's show notes. A lot of people living with MS are worried about whether their disease-modifying therapy might make them more susceptible to COVID-19 or worsen its symptoms if they contract the virus. So it may be a bit of ironic news to learn that a research team in Hong Kong has identified one MS disease-modifying therapy as being helpful in enabling people to recover from COVID-19 more quickly if the drug is given as part of a 3-drug cocktail at the early stages of the virus. Patients who were given the MS medication interferon beta-1b, commercially known as Betaseron or Xtavia, along with a combination HIV drug and an antiviral drug, took 7 days to recover from mild to moderate cases of COVID-19, and patients who were only given the HIV combination drug, well, they took 12 days to recover. Now, the fact that this news is coming out of Hong Kong is interesting. Hong Kong has managed COVID-19 differently. In Hong Kong, everyone diagnosed with COVID-19 has been required to go to a hospital for treatment, regardless of the severity of their symptoms. Now, none of the 127 people being tracked in this study were critically ill, and none of the 127 patients died. It's also worth noting that through May 8th, Hong Kong has only recorded 4 deaths due to COVID-19. So the research team has warned that this treatment may be less effective in more seriously ill patients. And that reminds us that, like MS itself, Early treatment of COVID-19 may produce better patient outcomes. I also want to point out that this study was not blinded, meaning that the doctors and nurses treating the patients knew which ones were getting the interferon beta-1b and which patients were only receiving the combination HIV drugs. And this study didn't have a group receiving a placebo to compare it with the effectiveness of the interferon beta-1b treatment. So we can expect to see larger, blinded clinical trials taking place to further test this treatment under what are traditionally considered scientific conditions. As with all things related to COVID-19, please stay tuned. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, I'll include a link in today's show notes. And speaking of studies, we're beginning to see data about the effect of COVID-19 on people living with MS coming from the newly established patient registries and from the Italian MS organizations. In a moment, I'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Robert Shin, and Dr. Shin will give us an update on what the experts are learning from this initial data. My guest today is Dr. Robert Shin. Dr. Shin is a professor of neurology at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital and a fellow of the American Neurological Association and the American Academy of Neurology. He's a graduate of Yale University, and Dr. Shin received his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Shin has a special interest in visual problems associated with multiple sclerosis and other demyelinating disorders, including optic neuritis and double vision. He's been widely published in medical journals and textbooks, and he's a frequent lecturer dedicated to patient and staff education. Dr. Shin has received multiple awards and commendations for his teaching expertise and his clinical excellence. Well, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Shin.
Thanks for having me.
You know, for the past 8 weeks, there really hasn't been any data about the effects of COVID-19 on people living with MS. But during that time, a joint effort has been launched between the National MS Society, the Consortium of MS Centers, and the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Canada to capture information on the outcomes of people with MS and other demyelinating diseases who have developed COVID-19. And in Italy, which was the first European country to really suffer the effects of the pandemic, the Italian Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Italian Multiple Sclerosis Foundation, and the Multiple Sclerosis Study Group of the Italian Neurological Society have actually published preliminary findings from the data that they've been collecting. So now that we're beginning to see some of this data, albeit limited data, what are we starting to learn about the impact of COVID-19 on people living with MS?
Well, you know, in some sense, as you said, we don't have a lot of information, but I think maybe no news is good news in the sense that there certainly hasn't been a signal that suggested that MS patients have either been more vulnerable to COVID-19 or have fared worse. The other, I think, encouraging thing is that it doesn't really seem like, as far as we can tell, patients on certain MS treatments versus other treatments seem to have fared any differently. So I think we should be grateful to our Italian colleagues. Obviously, they were more on the leading edge. They were hit harder and hit earlier than we were. So it's great that they've been willing to share their experiences with us. It was a relatively small number of patients. But again, I think the take-home message so far is that we haven't seen extra vulnerability in our MS patients. Above and beyond the concerns, obviously, that all of us are taking today.
Every day, it seems throughout the day, the media reminds us of the heartbreaking number of people who have died after contracting COVID-19. And as I watch the morning news shows, they're still showing video of one single patient being discharged from the hospital after overcoming the virus. But I think this can maybe create a false and somewhat frightening narrative about the survivability of COVID-19. So I'm wondering, what does the reality actually look like? Do you know what percentage of people who contract COVID-19 are even admitted to a hospital? And then what's the likelihood that someone who is diagnosed with COVID-19 is going to make a recovery?
Right. That's a great point that I think, obviously, the things that make for a good soundbite or video clip don't always capture the entirety of the process. Some of the numbers are hard to come by, mostly because we don't actually know exactly how many people have contracted COVID-19 because we have still somewhat limited and fragmented testing. But I think what I can say based on what we've learned so far is that a large number of people, possibly most people, can contract COVID-19 without really any symptoms or minimal symptoms at all. And that's why it's hard to calculate the exact number because we only are aware of maybe the patients who develop more severe symptoms, who develop fever or cough enough to go call a doctor, call their primary, and maybe to get tested. But even then, I would emphasize many people with COVID-19, even with significant symptoms, recover really just at home. And most of them actually don't have to go to the hospital. It's really only a smaller percentage of patients who develop more severe symptoms with significant shortness of breath, or I would say patients with pre-existing medical conditions that make them more fragile, whether that's older age, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease that's pre-existing that need to be hospitalized. And then even among those patients hospitalized, a smaller number end up having to go to an intensive care unit. And then again, even a smaller fraction need to be intubated, for example. I do have to be honest and say that COVID-19 can be severe. So when patients are critically ill, it's been a challenge to support them and try to get them through it. Some people can make it, but many people succumb, as we've learned in the U.S. You know, I think we're beyond 70,000 deaths. So it's certainly that's concerning, but the chance of a severe outcome like that is relatively low in the general population. And to the best of my ability to tell, from the limited data we have, that goes for MS patients as well. The vast majority of them, if they get COVID-19, will have an unremarkable course. That's been the experience in Europe. And thus far as I'm aware, that's been our experience in the U.S. Keep in mind that many MS patients are in a younger age group, which, as we know, they do tend to do better. You know, if we're fortunate enough and we've helped them control their MS and they may not have any other medical issues other than their MS, I think their chance of being severely ill is actually quite low. We all need to take precautions, but I think it is probably good to also try to reassure your listeners with MS that they need to take the standard precautions that we all need to take. But the risk for them based on MS or even an MS treatment doesn't appear to be really any different than anyone else's.
Speaking of MS treatments, a couple of weeks ago, one of my guests was a registered nurse who's living with MS, and she's actually fully recovered after being diagnosed with COVID-19 back in March. Now, one of the things that she mentioned was a concern was perhaps changing her disease-modifying therapy, which is Ocrevus, because she wanted to be able to benefit from a COVID-19 vaccine when one becomes available. I'm hoping you can explain the interaction that she was concerned about between disease-modifying therapies like Ocrevus and some vaccines.
Sure. It's actually an important concern and an important issue. We really don't have complete answers to this, obviously. But I think one thing she may be alluding to is an observation that with some MS medications, whether it's Ocrevus or other treatments, there could be an effect on the immune system that might itself not just control MS, but might also alter the body's ability to respond to a vaccine. So remember, the concept of a vaccine is that we give some kind of stimulus and we let the body react to that vaccine in a way that creates protection from infections in the future. So for example, every year we encourage people to get the flu shot. And really what we're using is it's not a live virus. It's an inactivated, maybe dead virus. And then when the body sees that, it makes antibodies against it. And then if they bump into the flu virus in the flu season, then hopefully they'll be better prepared to fight it. Now, our MS patients on certain treatments, we've observed, for example, to use Ocrevus specifically, that if somebody is on Ocrevus, and then they need to be vaccinated for something, flu shot or, you know, some other vaccine that they were due for. It's been observed that although they do respond, they do mount a response to the vaccine the titer, the blood levels of the antibodies that are formed do seem to be lower. So it's thought that a drug like Ocrevus may affect the body's ability to mount an immune response. Now, again, I would emphasize the patient that studied still responded to the vaccine, but maybe to a slightly lesser degree. Up to this point, I think we've always felt that if we were doing sort of like trying to weigh the two sides of the scale, we've always thought that, well, treating the MS is so important that that would outweigh a small effect on the response to vaccination. Now, your caller had brought up this challenge, the sort of future challenge. Keep in mind that actually we unfortunately do not have a vaccine to COVID-19. And although we hear different things in the media, I will be honest, I think that it could be more than a year away. So this is a hypothetical concern, but someday we will have a vaccine against COVID-19, and the caller's concerned about whether the MS treatment might affect it. I have to say, this is just my personal opinion, with so many unknowns, with so many question marks, with so many hypothetical issues, I'm reluctant to make changes in treatment planning today based on hypothetical concerns for the future. In other words, if at this moment, for any individual person, having a conversation with a healthcare provider, drug X, Y, Z, Q, whatever, seems to be the most safe and effective drug for that person at this moment, my feeling is we should still go with that and not let hypothetical concerns in the future occur. As I said, from what we've seen in the past, people who need vaccinations, no matter what their MS medication, are able to respond to the vaccines to a greater or lesser degree. And I think that if we get to that future place, with the vaccine available, we would find out whether different MS treatments affect the ability to mount a response. So that's sort of a long-winded answer, but I think my vote would be for us to try not to be swayed by hypothetical concerns at this time until we have more data to base our decisions on.
I think that makes just so much sense. Thank you for that clarification. You know, as we speak, 47 states are in the process of at least partially reopening for business. What should people living with MS be thinking about as these states begin to roll back their shelter-in-place orders?
Well, it's a challenging issue. And I think the fact that, at least in the United States, we have all different jurisdictions making slightly different rules and plans tells us that nobody really is exactly sure of the best way to go about doing this. There's certainly a tension in the sense that social distancing, isolation, not only does it clearly, you know, hypothetically prevent the spread of COVID, it has clearly done so. As we've shut down across the nation, the spread of coronavirus, COVID-19, has been slowed, actually. We have actually, in many respect, at least in certain areas, flattened the curve. So there is a good to this kind of isolation and shutdown. But then there's the bad, which is the economy and, you know, people being out of a job, having no way to support themselves or their family, or let's say difficulties in getting necessary supplies because factories aren't open. So there's no way to really do either extreme. So we're all trying to figure out what is the right delicate balance. How can we reopen businesses and stores and allow people to get a paycheck again and to support their family and to get the goods they need, but not allow a second wave of infections to occur by us all bumping into each other? So I don't have the exact answers to this, but what I think we know is that we all have a responsibility to minimize spread as best we can. That includes wearing masks when we go outdoors, not to not get it, not to say I'm afraid of getting it. The mask is for me to say, I don't want to give it to you by accident. I'm trying to protect you by my wearing of a mask. And social distancing is the same thing. It's not that I'm afraid of getting it from you. It's that I don't want to accidentally give it to you. And if we all were to look out for each other in this way, you know, we could, I think, kind of minimize the spread. So I don't have the right answer for when governors need to open states back up. But as we open up our businesses, as we go back out into our maybe restaurants for, you know, takeout or to our businesses, you know, in limited ways, I think we all need to be vigilant and try to minimize the risk of spreading the pseudo. That means social distancing in terms of distance, but also in terms of time. We need to be sure that if we do have to be in an office with someone else, not only do we maintain distance, but we minimize the amount of time that has to be spent in that office. If you're an employee, if your job involves being in close personal contact with someone, we got to do what we got to do, but let's take precautions that we don't spread it to each other. So maybe let's wear masks if possible, but also minimize our time interacting with that person, not to be unfriendly, but simply to protect each other. I think that's the best I can recommend at this time. This is an evolving subject.
I'm wondering whether, as we do reopen businesses in our communities, do people with MS who may also be living with other medical conditions besides multiple sclerosis, things like high blood pressure, diabetes, or even obesity, do they have additional considerations to make here?
Well, the short answer is absolutely. So, but in a way, MS can be taken out of the equation, as far as I can tell at this time, meaning that certainly an individual who has MS and who has diabetes or who has asthma or has a history of heart disease or is maybe elderly, or more frail more disabled may have to take extra precautions above and beyond what I've outlined, meaning that maybe someone like that might have to be even more careful to self-isolate or to stay away from situations where they could acquire COVID-19, because it's the other medical complications that seem to increase the risk of a bad outcome. That's obesity, it's diabetes, it's heart disease, it's lung disease. These seem to be the issues. Actually borne out in the Italian study you mentioned, that it seemed as though the people who did poorly with MS had nothing to do with their MS or their MS drug. It had more to do with how old they were and how much pre-existing disability they had. So it's true. There are some populations that need to take extra care. But in some sense, that's independent of whether they have MS or not. It's really almost every other factor thus far, not necessarily the MS per se.
COVID-19 has ushered in an era that we're all calling the new normal. It certainly affected the current practice of medicine. Do you see ways that COVID-19 might impact the future of MS care?
Well, I'll be honest, I think it's a little premature to call this the new normal, because I don't even know what tomorrow will bring. Things are changing. Maybe the point is that it's a way to say that maybe things will never be the same again. And I think there are good and bad sides to that. So one example, I guess, that I can speak to in my own practice is that COVID-19 has forced us to be much better at virtual visits, e-visits, or telemedicine. So for a long time in the medical field, we talked about or played around with the idea of telemedicine, being able to bring medical expertise maybe into the community or to communities that may not have easy access to a healthcare professional or a specialist in that area. And I'll be honest, before this crisis, it sort of languished. We never really made that work. So the pressure of COVID-19 forced us in a short period of time to make platforms that allow us to do video visits with patients in real time, and have allowed us to figure out how to take care of people in broad geographic distribution remotely. And so to me, that would be one silver lining. If our advances in technology that were forced upon us allow us to deliver better care after this crisis ends. I would love it if, an individual who's, I'm just going to make this up, in a part of the country where there are no MS specialists for, hours, 7 hours away to get to an MS center, would have access to MS care, to a virtual platform. If we can deliver care to more individuals with MS using technology, then I would say that's maybe a silver lining from this crisis. I would also say that for what it's worth, we could reevaluate, I'll be honest, our treatment of, let's say, older patients with MS. Because one dilemma has always been, we use these MS treatment options for 20, 30, 40-year-olds, but for our patients who are over the age of 50, over the age of 60, over the age of 70, we never really figured out, should they be on an MS medicine? Should they not be on an MS medicine? Are we hurting their immune? Are we not? So I think this crisis is forcing us to examine that situation more closely. We know that the elderly are more vulnerable to this virus. It has nothing to do with MS or not. They're more vulnerable. But for our MS patients in an older age group, I think maybe we should be more thoughtful in how we manage their MS and pay more attention to potential safety concerns in that age group.
Well, Dr. Robert Chin, thank you for all you do every day to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And as we make our way through the days and weeks ahead, I hope you'll share this podcast with others who might also gain some benefit from listening. You can share this episode of Real Talk MS by letting people know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/141. It's realtalkms.com/141. And you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. I don't think that I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified, and in some cases multiplied, the challenges of living with MS. From having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. Perhaps more than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can meet the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and support groups on the fly, so no one has to face MS alone. They serve as a reliable partner to navigate the challenges of COVID-19 and MS. They've created resources and provided information so that healthcare providers can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical policy decisions. And they've never stopped advancing research to find a cure. That's why I'm asking that, as we're able, each of us steps up and supports the National MS Society. To donate, you can text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. Or, if you prefer, I've created an online shortcut to get you to that same webpage, so you can visit realtalkms.com/COVID-19-response-fund and make your donation. So just to review, you can text the word GIVE to 68686, or point your web browser at realtalkms.com/COVID-19-response-fund. And COVID-19 Response Fund is all one word. But however you choose to contribute, please contribute today. It's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.